The Regulators by Richard Bachman. Read by Kate Nelligan. Poplar Street, 3:45 p.m., July 15th, 1996. Summer's here. Not just summer, either, not this year, but the apotheosis, the avatar, high, green, perfect central Ohio summer, dead smash in the middle of July. White sun glaring out of that faded Levi sky. The sound of kids hollering through the bare street woods at the top of the hill. The tink of bats from the ball field. The sound of power mowers, muscle cars, rollerblades, radios. And surrounding everything like an auditory edging of lace, the silky hiss of lawn sprinklers. Summer in Wentworth, Ohio, here on Poplar Street, which runs straight through the middle of the American dream, with the smell of hot dogs in the air and a few burst paper remains of 4th of July firecrackers still lying in the gutters. It's been hot, but it's also been dry, with no water but the occasional flipped spray of a hose to stir those last shreds of Chinese paper. That may change today. There's an occasional rumble of thunder from the west, and those watching the Weather Channel know that thunderstorms are expected. Maybe even a tornado, though that's unlikely. On the block of poplar which runs between Bear Street at the top of the hill and Hyacinth at the bottom, there are 11 houses and one store. The store, on the corner of Poplar and Hyacinth, is the ever-popular convenience mart, where you can get your cigarettes, your rolling rock, your candy, your barbecue supplies, your popsicles. You can even get a copy of Penthouse at the Easy Stop 24 if you want one, but you have to ask the clerk. The clerk today is new, less than a week on the job, and right now, at 3:45, she's waiting on a little boy and girl. The girl looks about 11 and is already on her way to being a beauty. The boy, clearly her little brother, is maybe 6 and on his way to being a first-class booger snot.
"I want 2 candy bars," he exclaims.
"There's only enough money for one, if we each have a soda," pretty sis tells him with what the clerk thinks is admirable patience.
"Mom gave you $5 this morning. I saw it,"
the booger snot says. The girl has long, honey-blonde hair, which the clerk thinks is gorgeous. Her own hair is short and kinky, dyed orange on the right, green on the left. Pretty sister is looking at her hair with fascination.
"Margaret, Margaret, Margaret,"
the little boy crows with the cheerfully energetic viciousness only little brothers can muster. "My name is really Ellen," the girl says. "Margaret's my middle name. He calls me that because he knows I hate it."
"Nice to meet you, Ellen,"
the clerk says and begins totting up the girl's purchases.
"Nice to meet you, Margaret,"
the booger snot brother mimics, screwing his face into an expression so strenuously awful that it is funny. Ignoring him, Ellen says, "I love your hair."
"Thanks,"
the clerk says, smiling, "though it's not as nice as yours. That's $1.46. The girl takes a little plastic change purse from the pocket of her jeans. Inside are 2 crumpled dollar bills.
"Ask Margaret the maggot where the other $3 went,"
the booger snot trumpets.
"She used it to buy a magazine with Ethan Hawke on the cover."
Ellen goes on ignoring him, although her cheeks are getting a little red. As she hands over the $2, she says, "Well, it's nice to meet you. I'm Ellie Carver, and this is my little brother, Ralph." Ralph Carver sticks out his tongue and makes a sound like a wasp caught in a mayonnaise jar.
"I'm Cynthia Smith," she says, extending her hand over the counter to the girl. "Always a Cynthia and never a Cindy."
The girl smiles. "And I'm always an Ellie, never a Margaret."
"Margaret the maggot. You're gonna pull me and Buster,"
he says as they leave,
"all the way home."
"Like hell I am," Ellie says. July 15th, the very roof tree of summer, in a town where most kids go to vacation Bible school and participate in the summer reading program at the public library, and where one kid has just got to have a little red wagon he has named Buster. 90 degrees in the shade, and the air shimmers above the pavement. The block runs north-south, odd-numbered houses on the Los Angeles side of the street, even-numbered ones on the New York side. At the top, on the western corner, is 251 Poplar. Brad Josephson is out front, using the hose to water the flower beds beside the front path.
He is 46, with gorgeous chocolate skin and a long, sloping gut. He and Belinda Josephson are the only black people on the block, and they look just the way people in suburban Ohio like their black people to look. Everyone likes the Josephsons. Carrie Ripton, who delivers the Wentworth Shopper on Monday afternoons, comes peddling around the corner and tosses Brad a rolled-up paper. Brad catches it deftly with his free hand. "Good one, Mr. Josephson," Carrie calls, and pedals on downhill with his canvas sack bouncing on his hip. He's wearing an oversized Orlando Magic jersey with Shaq's number, 32, on it. "I ain't lost it yet," Brad says, and tucks the nozzle of the hose under his arm so he can open the weekly handout and see what's on the front page. Across the street at 250, Johnny Marinville is sitting on his front step, playing his guitar and singing along. Brad has always found this slightly offensive. A man who's good at one thing should be content with that and let the rest go, he feels. Carrie Ripton, 14, crew cut, backup shortstop for the Wentworth American Legion team, tosses the next shopper onto the porch of 249. The Sodersons, Gary and Marielle, are the Poplar Street Bohemians. On the scales of public opinion, they pretty much balance each other out. Gary is, by and large, a help-out kind of guy, liked by his neighbors, in spite of the fact that he's at least half-lit nearly all of the time. Marielle, however... Carrie's throw is a perfect bank shot, bouncing the shopper off the Sodersen front door and landing it spang on the Sodersen welcome mat, but no one comes out to get it. Marielle is taking a shower, and Gary is out back, fueling the barbecue, loading it with enough briquettes to flash fry an ox. He is wearing an apron with the words, "You may kiss the cook," on the front. On an umbrella-shaded picnic table is Gary's portable bar, a bottle of olives, a bottle of gin, and an unopened bottle of vermouth. A double martini stands in front of it. Gary finishes overloading the barbecue, goes to the table, and swallows what's left in the glass. He is very partial to martinis, and tends to be in the bag by four or so most days when he doesn't have to teach. "All right," Gary says, "next case." He makes another Sodersen martini by A, filling his glass to the three-quarters point with Bombay gin, B, popping in an Amati olive, C, tipping the rim of the glass against the unopened bottle of the vermouth for good luck. He tastes, closes his eyes, tastes again. "Yes," he tells his simmering backyard, "we have a winner." Over all the other sounds of summer, he can hear Marinville's guitar, an easy and sweet sound. He picks out the tune and dances around the circle of shade thrown by the umbrella with his glass in his hand, singing along. "So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you wait for me." For just a moment, he is struck by the reality of time's passage. How stark it is and unappealable. He takes another big sip of his martini and wonders what to do now that the barbecue is ready for liftoff. He can hear the shower upstairs and thinks of Marielle naked in there. The bitch of the Western world, but she's in good shape. He thinks of her soaping her breasts, maybe caressing her nipples. He decides to be a 20th century version of St. George. He will fuck the dragon instead of slaying it. He puts his martini glass down on the picnic table and starts for the house. Summertime, and on Poplar Street, the living is easy. Carrie Ripton checks his rearview mirror for traffic, sees none, and swerves easterly across the street to the Carver house. He hasn't bothered with Mr. Marinville because at the start of the summer, Mr. Marinville gave him $5 not to deliver the shopper. "Please, Carrie," he said, his eyes solemn and earnest. "I can't read about another supermarket opening. It'll kill me." Carrie doesn't understand him in the slightest, but he's nice enough, and $5 is $5. Mrs. Carver opens the front door of 248 Poplar and waves as Carrie easy tosses her the shopper. She grabs for it, misses completely, and laughs. Carrie laughs with her. She's a good sport. Her husband is beside the house, wearing his bathing suit and flip-flops, washing the car. He turns, points a finger. Carrie points one right back, and they pretend to shoot each other. This is Mr. Carver's game effort to be cool, and Carrie respects that. David Carver works for the post office, and Carrie figures he must be on vacation this week. The boy makes a vow to himself. If he ever has to settle for a regular 9-to-5 job, he will never spend his vacation washing his car in the driveway. I'm not going to have a car anyway, he thinks. Going to have a motorcycle. Big old Harley Davidson like the one Mr. Marinville keeps in his garage. He checks the rear view again and catches sight of something bright red up on Bear Street beyond the Josephson place. A van, it looks like, parked just beyond the intersection, and then swoops his Schwinn back across the street, this time to 247, the Weiler place. Of the occupied houses on the street, 242, the old Hobart place, is vacant. The Weiler place is the only one approaching seedy. It's a small, ranch-style home that could use a fresh coat of paint and a fresh coat of driveway seal. There's a sprinkler twirling on the lawn, but the grass has yellow patches, small but spreading. She doesn't know that water isn't enough, Carrie thinks, reaching into his canvas bag for another rolled-up shopper. Her husband might have, but he suddenly realizes that she is standing inside the screen door, and something about seeing her there, hardly more than a silhouette, startles him badly. He wobbles on his bike for a moment, and when he throws the rolled-up paper, his aim is way off. The shopper lands atop one of the shrubs flanking the front steps. He hates doing that. It's like some stupid comedy show where the paperboy is always throwing one onto the roof or into the rose bushes. And on a different day, he might have gone back to rectify the error. Not today, though. There's something here he doesn't like. Something about the way she's standing inside the screen door, shoulders slumped and hands dangling, like a kid's toy with the batteries pulled. And that's maybe not all that's out of kilter, either. He can't see well enough to be sure, but he thinks maybe she's naked from the waist up, standing in her front hall wearing nothing but a pair of shorts. The kid that stays with her, her nephew, he's creepy too. Seth Garland or Garen or something like that. He never talks, even if you talk to him. Just looks at you with his mud-colored eyes. Looks at you the way Carrie feels Mrs. Weiler, who is usually nice, is looking at him now. Like, step into my parlor, said the spider to the fly. Her husband died last year, right around the time the Hobarts had that trouble and moved away. And people say it wasn't an accident. People say that Herb Weiler, who had once given Carrie an old air rifle, committed suicide. Goose flesh ripples up his back, and he banks across the street after another cursory look in the mirror. The red van is still up there near the corner, and this time there is a blue Acura coming down the street as well. Mr. Jackson. Actually, Professor Jackson. Or maybe just assistant professor. At Ohio State. The Jacksons live at 244, one up from the old Hobart place. It's the nicest house on the block. A roomy Cape Cod with a high hedge on the downhill side, and a high cedar stake fence on the uphill side between them and the old veterinarian's place. Yo, Carrie, Peter Jackson says, pulling up beside him. He's wearing faded jeans and a T-shirt with a big yellow smile face on it. How's it going, bad boy? Great, Mr. Jackson, Carrie says, smiling. He thinks of adding, except I think Mrs. Weiler's standing in her door back there with her shirt off, and then doesn't. Everything's super cool. Starting any games yet? Only two so far, but that's okay. I got a couple of innings last night, and I'll probably get a couple more tonight. But it's Frankie Albertini's last year in Legion, you know. He holds out a rolled copy of the shopper. That's right, Peter says, taking it, and next year it's Monsieur Carrie Ripton's turn to howl at shortstop. The boy laughs, tickled at the idea of standing out there in his uniform and howling like a werewolf. A large furry shape bullets by, chasing a red disc. Carrie leans his bike and is just feathered by Hannibal's tail as the German shepherd chases after a frisbee, snatching it off the sidewalk. He has a jaunty bandana tied around his neck and appears to be wearing a big old doggy grin. Bring it back, Hannibal, Jim Reed calls, and his twin brother, Dave, joins in. Come on, Hannibal, don't be a dork, fetch! Hannibal stands in front of 246, across from the Weiler house, with the frisbee in his mouth and his tail waving back and forth slowly. The grin appears to widen. The Reed twins live at 245, a house down from Mrs. Weiler. They are standing at the edge of their lawn. One dark, one light, both tall and handsome in cut-off T-shirts and identical Eddie Bauer shorts, staring across the street at Hannibal. Behind them are a couple of girls, One is Susie Geller from next door. Pretty, but not, you know, kabam. The other, a redhead with long cheerleader legs, is a different story. Her picture could be next to kabam in the dictionary. Carrie doesn't know her, but he would like to know her. Her hopes and dreams and plans and fantasies. Especially the fantasies. Not in this life, he thinks. She's 17 if she's a day. Oh, sugar, Jim Reed says, then turns to his dark-haired sib. You go get it this time. No way, it'll be all spitty, Dave Reed says. Hannibal, be a good dog. Bring that back here. Hannibal stands on the sidewalk in front of Doc's house, still grinning. Nyeh, nyeh, he says without having to say anything. It's all in the grin and the regally serene sweep of the tail. Nyeh, nyeh, you've got girls in Eddie Bauer shorts, but I got your frisbee, and I'm leaking canine spit all over it. Carrie reaches into his pocket and pulls out a bag of sunflower seeds. I got you covered, he calls back to the Reed twins, hoping the sweet little redhead will be impressed. Knowing that this is a dream so foolish only a kid between his freshman and sophomore years could entertain it, but she looks so wonderful in those cuffed white shorts she's wearing, and when did a little fantasy ever hurt? He drops the bag of sunflower seeds down to dog level and crackles the cellophane. Hannibal comes at once, still with the red frisbee caught in the center of his grin. Carrie pours a few seeds into his palm. Good, Hannibal, he says. These are good. Loved by dogs all over the world. Hannibal studies the seeds a moment longer, nostrils quivering delicately, then drops the frisbee onto Poplar Street and vacuums them out of Carrie's palm. Quick as a flash, the boy bends, grabs the frisbee, it is sort of spitty around the edges, and scales it back at Jim Reed. It's a perfect floating toss, one Jim can grab without moving a single step. And oh God, oh Jesus, the redhead is applauding him, bouncing up and down next to Susie Geller, her boobs jiggling inside the halter she's wearing. Oh, thank you, Lord. We now have enough jack-off material in our memory banks to last at least a week. Grinning, unaware that he will die both a virgin and a backup shortstop, Carrie throws a shopper onto the stoop of Tom Billingsley's house and swoops across the street again toward the Reeds. Dave tosses the frisbee to Susie Geller, then takes the shopper when Carrie flips it to him. Thanks for getting the frisbee back, Dave says. No problem. He nods toward the redhead. Who's she? Dave laughs, not unkindly. Never mind, little man, don't even bother. Above and behind them, at the top of the hill, the red van begins to move, creeping slowly up on the corner. You coming to the game tonight? Carrie asks Dave Reed. We got the Columbus Rebels, should be good. You gonna play? I should get a couple of innings in the field and at least one AB. Probably not, then, Dave says and yodels a laugh which makes Carrie wince. The Reed twins look like young gods, he thinks, but when they open their mouths, they bear a suspicious resemblance to the Hager twins of Hee-Haw. Carrie glances down toward the house on the corner of Poplar and Hyacinth, across from the store. The last house on the left, as in the horror movie of the same name. There is no car in the driveway, but that means nothing. It could be in the garage. He home? He asks Dave, lifting his chin at 2:40. Dunno, Jim says, coming over. But you hardly ever do you? Half the time he leaves his damn car in the garage and cuts through the woods to Hyacinth. Probably takes the bus to wherever it is he goes. You scared of him? Dave asks Carrie. He's not exactly taunting, but it's close. Shit, no, Carrie says, cool, looking at the redhead. Wondering about how it would feel to have a package like her in his arms, all sleek and springy, maybe slipping him a little tongue as she snuggled up to his boner. Not in this life, bub, he thinks again. He tosses her a wave, is outwardly noncommittal and inwardly overjoyed when she returns it, then sails diagonally down the street toward 240 Poplar. He'll deliver the shopper onto the porch with his usual hard flip, and then, if the crazy ex-cop doesn't come charging out of the front door, foaming at the mouth, and glaring at him with stoned PCP eyes, Carrie will go across to the easy stop for a soda to celebrate another successful negotiation of his route. Anderson Avenue to Columbus Broad, Columbus Broad to Bear Street, Bear Street to Poplar Street, then home to change into his uniform and off to the baseball wars. First, however, there is 240 Poplar to get behind him, home of the ex-cop, Collier and Trajan, who reputedly lost his job for beating a couple of innocent Northside kids to death because he thought they raped a little girl. Carrie has no idea if there's any truth to it, but he has seen the man's eyes, and there's something in them, a vacancy that makes you want to look away, just as soon as you can, without appearing uncool. At the top of the hill, the red van, if that's what it is, it's so gaudy and customized it's hard to tell, turns onto Poplar. It begins to pick up speed. The sound of its engine is a cadenced, silky whisper. And what, pray tell, is that chrome gadget on the roof? Johnny Merrinville stops playing his guitar to watch the van slide past. He can't see inside because the windows are polarized, but the thing on the roof looks like a chrome-plated radar dish. God damn if it doesn't. Has the CIA landed on Poplar Street? Across from him, Johnny sees Brad Josephson standing on his lawn, still holding his hose in one hand and his shopper in the other. Brad is also gaping after the slow-moving van. Is it a van, though? Is it? His expression is a mixture of wonder and perplexity. Arrows of sun glint off the bright red paint and the chrome below the dark windows. Arrows so bright they make Johnny wince. Next door to Johnny, David Carver is still washing his car. He's enthusiastic, you have to give him that. He's got that Chevy of his buried in soap suds all the way to the wiper blades. The red van rolls past him, humming and glinting. On the other side of the street, the Reed twins and their gal pals stop their front lawn frisbee game to look. The kids make a rectangle. In the center of it sits Hannibal, panting happily. In the distance, thunder rumbles. Carrie Ripton barely notices the van in his rearview mirror, or the bright yellow Ryder truck which turns left from Hyacinth onto Poplar, pulling onto the tarmac of the Easy Stop, where the Carver kids are still standing by Buster the Red Wagon and squabbling over whether Ralph will be pulled up the hill by his sister or not. The kids break off their argument, noticing the white steam hissing out of the Ryder truck's grill like dragon's breath. But Carrie Ripton pays zero attention to the truck's problems. His attention is focused on one thing only, delivering the crazy ex-copper's shopper and then getting away. The ex-copper is the only person on the block with a no trespassing sign on his lawn. It's small, it's discreet, but it's there. If he killed a couple of kids, how come he's not in jail, Carrie wonders, and not for the first time. He decides he doesn't care. The man's continued freedom isn't his business on this sultry afternoon. Survival is. With all this on his mind, it's no wonder Carrie doesn't notice the Ryder truck with the steam pouring out of its grill, or the two kids who have momentarily ceased their complicated negotiations, or the van coming down the hill. He is concentrating on not becoming a psycho cop's next victim. And this is ironic, since his fate is actually approaching from behind. One of the van's side windows begins to slide down. A shotgun barrel pokes out. It is an odd color, not quite silver, not quite gray. The twin muzzles look like the symbol for infinity, colored black. Somewhere beyond the blazing sky, afternoon thunder rumbles again. Steve Ames saw the shooting because of the two kids arguing beside the red wagon in front of the store. The girl looked seriously pissed at the little boy, and for one second Steve was sure she was going to give him a shove, which might send him sprawling across the wagon and in front of the truck. Running over a brat in a Bart Simpson shirt in central Ohio would certainly be the perfect end to this totally fucked up day. As he stopped, well short of them, better safe than sorry, he saw their attention had been diverted to the steam pouring out of his radiator. Beyond them, in the street, was a red van, maybe the brightest red Steve had ever seen in his life. The paint job wasn't what attracted his eye, however. What did was the shiny chrome doodad on the van's roof. It looked like some sort of futuristic radar dish, swinging back and forth in a short, repeating arc, too, the way that radar dishes did. There was a kid riding a bike on the far side of the street. The van slid over toward him, as if the driver wanted to talk to him. The kid had no idea it was there. He had just taken a rolled-up newspaper from the sack on his hip and was cocking his arm back to throw it. Steve turned off the Ryder truck's ignition without thinking about what he was doing. He no longer heard the steady hiss from the radiator, or saw the kid standing by the red wagon, or thought about what he was going to say when he called the 800 number the Ryder people gave you in case of engine trouble. Once or twice in his life, he'd had little precognitive flashes, psychic nudges, but he was now gripped not by a flash, but by a kind of cramp, a certainty that something was going to happen. He didn't see the double barrel poking out of the van's side window. He was placed wrong for that. But he heard the kabam of the shotgun and knew immediately what it was. He had grown up in Texas and had never mistaken gunfire for thunder. The kid flew off the seat of his bike, shoulders twisted, legs bent, hat flying off his head. The back of his T-shirt was shredded, and Steve could see more than he wanted to. Red blood and black, torn flesh. The kid's throwing hand had been cocked to his ear, and the folded paper tumbled behind him into the dry gutter as the kid hit the lawn of the small house on the corner in a boneless, graceless forward roll. The van stopped in the middle of the street just short of the Poplar Hyacinth intersection, engine idling. Steve Ames sat behind the wheel of his rented truck, mouth open, as a small window set into the van's right rear side slid down. "I didn't know they could do that," he thought. He became aware that someone had come out of the store, a girl in the sort of blue smock top that checkout people usually wore. She had one hand up to her forehead, shielding her eyes from the sun. He became aware that a double-barreled shotgun was now poking out of the window which had just slid down. And he became aware of the two children standing by their red wagon, out in the open, totally exposed, and looking in the direction from which the first shots had come. Hannibal, the German shepherd, saw one thing, the rolled-up newspaper which fell from Carrie Ripton's hand as the shotgun blast pushed him off his bicycle seat and out of his life. Hannibal charged, barking happily. "Hannibal, no!" Jim Reed shouted. He had no idea what was going on, but he didn't like it. Without thinking about what he was doing or why, he scaled the frisbee down the sidewalk toward the store, hoping to catch Hannibal's eye and divert him from his current course. Hannibal ignored the frisbee and arrowed for the fallen copy of The Shopper, which he could just see in front of the idling red van. Cynthia Smith also knew the sound of a shotgun when she heard one. Her minister father had shot skeet every Saturday when she was a little girl, and had frequently taken her along. This time, however, no one had yelled pull. She put down the paperback she had been reading, came around the counter, and hurried out onto the top step of the store. The glare hit her, and she raised a hand to shade her eyes. She saw the van idling in the middle of the street, saw the shotgun slide out of the back, saw it center on the Carver children. For a moment, she was frozen in place. Her brain told her legs to move, but nothing happened. "Go, go, go!" she screamed at herself, and that broke the ice sheathing her nerves. She lurched forward, almost falling down the three cement steps, and grabbed at the kids. The twin bores of the shotgun looked huge, gaping, and she saw that she was too late. That first frozen moment had been fatal. All she had managed to do was make sure that when the guy in the back of the van pulled the trigger, he would kill one 20-year-old road bunny as well as two little kids. David Carver dropped his sponge into the bucket of soapy water beside the right front tire of his Caprice and strolled down his driveway toward the street to see what was happening. Next door, one house up the hill on his right, Johnny Maranville was doing the same thing. He had hold of his guitar by the neck. On the other side, Brad Josephson was also walking down his lawn to the street, still holding his copy of The Shopper, the hose spouting into the grass behind him. "Was that backfire?" Johnny asked. He didn't think it had been. Back in his pre-Kitty Cat days, when he had still considered himself a serious writer, a phrase with all the pungency of a really good whore, to his way of thinking, Johnny had done a hellish research tour in Vietnam, and the sound he had just heard was more like the kind of backfires he had heard during the Tet Offensive. Jungle backfires, the kind that killed people. David shook his head, then turned his hands up to indicate he didn't really know. Behind him, the screen door of the cream and green ranch house banged shut, and they were running bare feet on the walk. It was Pi, wearing jeans and a blouse that had been buttoned wrong. Her hair clung to her head in a damp helmet. She still smelled of the shower. Was that a backfire? God, David, sounded like... Kirsten Carver, Kirsty to her friends, and Pi to her husband, for reasons probably only a husband could know, looked down the hill. David followed her gaze. He saw the idling van, and he saw the shotgun barrel sticking out of the right rear window.
Ellie! Ralph!
Pi screamed. It was a piercing cry, and behind the Sauderson house, Gary paused, listening, his martini glass halfway to his lips. Pi began to sprint down the hill toward the van.
Kirsten, no! Don't do that!
Brad Josephson yelled. He began to run after her, cutting into the street even as she did the same, angling to meet her in the middle, perhaps head her off between the Jacksons and the Gellers. He ran with surprising fleetness for such a big man, but saw after only a dozen steps that he wasn't going to catch her. David Carver also began to run after his wife, his gut bouncing up and down above his ridiculously tiny bathing suit, his flip-flops smacking the sidewalk and making a noise like cap pistols. His shadow ran after him in the street, long and thinner than he had ever been in his life. I'm dead, Cynthia thought, dropping to one knee behind and between the kids, reaching to encircle their shoulders with her arms, meaning to pull them against her. For all the good that would do. I'm dead. I'm totally dead. And she still couldn't take her eyes off the twin bores of the shotgun, holes so black, like pitiless eyes. The passenger door of the Ryder truck popped open, and she saw a lanky man in blue jeans and some sort of rock T-shirt, a guy with graying, shoulder-length hair and a craggy face.
Get him in here, lady, he yelled. Now!
She pushed the children toward the truck, knowing it was too late. And then, while trying to ready herself for the rip of the shots or the pellets, the gun poking from the rear of the van swiveled away from them, swiveled forward, along the van's red flank. It went off, the report rolling across the hot day like a bowling ball speeding down a gutter. Cynthia saw fire lick from the end of the barrel. The Reed's dog, in his final approach on the dropped newspaper, was thrown violently to the right, the grace slapped out of him as it had been slapped out of Carrie Ripton.
Hannibal!
Jim and Dave shrieked in unison. The sound made Cynthia think of the Doublemint twins. She shoved the Carver kids toward the open door of the truck so hard that Brother Boogersnot fell down. He started to bellow at once. The girl, always an Ellie, never a Margaret, looked back with heartbreaking bewilderment. Then the man with the long hair was hauling her by the arm up into the cab.
On the floor, kid. On the floor,
he shouted at her, then leaned out to grab the yowling boy. The rider's truck horn let out a brief blat. The driver had hooked one sneakered foot through the wheel to keep from sliding out head first. Cynthia batted the red wagon aside, grabbed the boogersnot by the back of his shorts, and lifted him into the truck driver's arms. Down the street, approaching, she could hear a man and a woman yelling the kids' names. Dad and Mom, she assumed, and apt to be shot down in the street like the dog and the paper boy if they didn't look out.
Get up here, the driver bawled at her,
and Cynthia scrambled into the overcrowded cab of the truck. Gary Sauderson came striding purposefully around the side of his house with his martini glass in hand. There had been a second loud bang, and he found himself wondering if maybe the Geller's gas grill had exploded. He saw Marinville standing in the middle of the street, shading his eyes and looking down the hill.
What be happening, my brother?
Gary asked, joining him. I think someone in that van down there just killed Carrie Ripton and then shot the Reed's dog, Johnny Marinville said in a strange, flat voice.
What? Why would anyone do that?
I have no idea. Carrie saw a couple, the Carvers, he was almost positive, running down the street toward the store, closely pursued by the galumphing Brad Josephson. Marinville turned to face him. This is bad shit. I'm calling the cops. In the meantime, I advise you to get off the street. Now. Marinville hurried up the walk to his house. Gary ignored his advice and stayed where he was, looking at the van idling down by the Intrajan place, suddenly wishing, and for him this was an exceedingly odd wish, that he wasn't quite so drunk. The door of the bungalow at 240 Poplar banged open, and Collian Trajan came charging out with a gun in his hand. Otherwise, however, he looked pretty much all right. No foam on the lips, no bloodshot, buggy eyes. He was a tall man, 6'4" at least, a little soft in the belly, but as broad and muscular through the shoulders as a linebacker. He wore khaki pants and no shirt. There was shaving cream on the left side of his face and a hand towel over his shoulder. The gun in his hand was a .38, and might very well have been the service pistol Carrie had often imagined while delivering the shopper to the house on the corner. Collie looked at the boy lying face down and dead on his lawn, his clothes already damp from the lawn sprinkler, and then at the van. He raised the pistol, clamping his left hand over his right wrist. Just as he did, the van began to roll. He almost fired anyway, then didn't. He had to be careful. There were people in Columbus, some of them very powerful, who would be delighted to hear that he had discharged a weapon on a suburban Wentworth street, a weapon he had been required by law to turn in. That's no excuse, and you know it, he thought, turning as the van rolled, pivoting with it. Fire your weapon! Fire your goddamn weapon! But he didn't. And as the van turned left onto Hyacinth, he saw there was no license plate on the back. And what about that silver gadget on the roof? What in God's name had that been? On the other side of the street, Mr. and Mrs. Carver were sprinting into the parking lot of the Easy Stop. Josephson was behind them. He glanced to the left and saw the red van had just disappeared behind the trees which screened the part of Hyacinth that ran east of Poplar, and then bent over, hands on knees, gasping for breath. Collie walked over to the yellow rental truck, noting the red wagon nearby. There were a couple of unopened sodas lying inside it. A squashed Three Musketeers candy bar lay beside one of the rear wheels. Screams from behind him. He turned and saw the Reed twins, their faces very pale beneath their summer tans, looking past their dog to the boy crumpled on his lawn. The twin with the blonde hair, Jim, he thought, began to cry. The other one took a step backward, grimaced, then bent forward and vomited onto his own bare feet. Crying loudly, Mrs. Carver lifted her son back out of the truck. The boy, also bawling at maximum volume, threw his arms around her neck and clung like a limpet.
Hush, she said. Hush, the bad man's gone.
David Carver took his daughter from the arms of the man lying awkwardly over the seat and enfolded her.
Daddy, you're getting me all soapy,
the girl protested. Carver kissed her brow between the eyes. Never mind, he said. Are you all right? She tried to look toward the street, and her father shielded her eyes. Collie went to the woman and the little boy. Is he okay, Mrs. Carver? She looked at him, not seeming to recognize him, and then turned her attention back to the squalling kid again, caressing his hair with one hand, seeming to devour him with her eyes.
Yes, I think so, she said. Are you okay, Ralphie? Are you?
The kid drew in a deep, hitching breath and bellowed,
Margaret's supposed to pull me up the hill! That was the deal!
The little snot sounded okay to Collie. He turned back toward the crime scene, noted the dog lying in a spreading pool of blood, noted that the blonde Reed twin was tentatively approaching the body of the unfortunate paper boy.
Stay away, Collie called sharply.
Jim Reed turned toward him.
But what if he's still alive?
What if he is? Have you got any hailing fairy dust to sprinkle on him? No? Then stand back.
The boy stepped toward his brother, then winced.
Oh, man, Davy. Look at your feet, he said, then turned aside and threw up himself. Colley and Trajan suddenly felt tumbled back into the job he thought he had left behind for good the previous October, when he had been bounced from the Columbus Police Department after a positive drug test. Cocaine and heroin. A good trick, since he had never taken either drug in his life. First priority, protect the citizenry. Second priority, aid the wounded. Third priority, secure the crime scene. Fourth priority, well, he'd worry about the fourth priority after he'd taken care of one, two, and three. The store's new day clerk, a skinny girl with double-colored hair that made Collie's eyes hurt, slid out of the truck and straightened her blue smock, which was badly askew. The truck's driver followed her. "You a cop?" he asked Collie. "Yes." Easier than trying to explain. "You folks get in the store, all of you. Brad? Boys?" He raised his voice a little on the last word, so the Reed twins would know he meant them. "No, I'd better get on back home," Brad said. He straightened up, glanced across the street at Carrie's body, then looked back at Collie. His expression was apologetic but determined. At least he was getting his breath back. For a minute or two, Collie had been reviewing what he remembered of his CPR classes. "Belinda's up there, and, It'd be better for you to come on in the store, Mr. Josephson, at least for the time being, in case the van comes back."
"Do you have any authority here?" Brad asked. His voice, although not exactly challenging, suggested that he knew Collie didn't. Collie folded his arms over his bare chest. The depression which had surrounded him since he'd been busted off the force had begun to lift a little in the last few weeks, but now he could feel it threatening again. After a moment, he shook his head. "No, no authority. Not these days." "Then I am going to my wife. No offense to you, sir." Collie had to smile a little at the careful dignity of the man's tone. "You don't diss me, and I don't diss you," it said. "None taken." The twins looked at each other uncertainly, then at Collie. He saw what they wanted and sighed. "All right, but go with Mr. Josephson, and when you get home, you and your friends go inside, okay?" The blonde boy nodded. "Jim? You are Jim, right?" The blonde boy nodded, wiping self-consciously at his red eyes. "Is your mom home? Or your dad?"
"Mom," he said. "Dad's still at work."
"Okay, boys. Go on. Hurry up. You too, Brad." "I'll do the best I can," Brad said, "but I think I have pretty well fulfilled my hurrying quota for the day."
The three of them started up the hill, along the west side of the street, where the odd-numbered houses were. "I'd like to take our kids home, too, Mr. Entragen," Kirsten Carver said. He sighed and nodded. "What the hell? Take them anywhere. Take them to Alaska." He wanted a cigarette, but they were back in the house. He had managed to quit for almost 10 years before the bastards downtown had first shown him the door and then run him through it. He had picked up the habit again with spooky speed. And now he wanted to smoke because he was nervous, not just cranked up because of the dead kid on his lawn, which would have been understandable, but nervous. "What's wrong with you? Too long out of work, getting squirrely? That's what's bugging you, Bubby?"
"No, that silver thing on the roof of the van. That's what's bugging me, Bubby."
"Oh, really?
Well, maybe not really, but it would do for a start. Or an excuse. In the end, a hunch was a hunch, and either you believed in them and played them or you didn't. He himself had always believed, and apparently a minor matter like getting fired hadn't changed their power over him. David Carver set his daughter down on her feet and took his blatting son from his wife. "I'll pull you in the wagon," he told the boy, "all the way up to the house. How's that?"
"Margaret the Maggot loves Ethan Hawke," his son confided.
"Does she? Well, maybe so, but you shouldn't call her that," David said. He spoke in the absent tones of a man who will forgive his child, well, one of his children anyway, just about anything. And his wife was looking at the kid with the eyes of one who regards a saint or a boy prophet. Only Collie and Trajan saw the look of dull hurt in the girl's eyes
as her revered brother was plumped down into the wagon, a look just too big and too sad to miss. He looked from her to the girl with the crazed hair and the aging hippie type from the rental truck. "Do you suppose I could get at least you to step inside until the police come?" he said. "Hey," the girl said, "sure." She was looking at him warily. "You're a cop, right?" The Carvers were drawing away, Ralph sitting cross-legged in his wagon, but they might still be close enough to overhear anything he said. And besides, what was he going to do, lie? "Used to be," he said. Clerk nodded. The guy with the long hair was looking at him curiously, but not disrespectfully. "You did a good job with the kids," he added, looking at her but speaking to both of them. Cynthia considered this, then shook her head. "It was a dog," she said. "If it hadn't distracted the guy, well, I think we'd be as dead as him now." She lifted her chin in the direction of Carrie Ripton, still dead and dampening on Collie's lawn. Then she led them into the easy stop.